Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Today we are talking about the latest cannabis news from the great state of California. And we are joined by senior attorney at Hoban Law Group, Patrick Goggin. Patrick, thank you for being here with us today.
Good to be here, Eric and Bob. Glad to join you on this sunny day out here in California.
Well, tell us how you're holding up in the midst of COVID out in San Francisco.
Well, we're doing pretty well. We've been under shelter in place now. We're into our fourth week. San Francisco and the Bay Area, six counties were the first to go into shelter in place, and on March 16th, and the state followed a little bit later in the week on the 19th and declared a statewide shelter in place. Governor Newsom was the lead on the first state to do so, and it really looks like we've flattened the curve, and so much so that we as a state are sending out ventilators supporting other states like New York, New Jersey, and Illinois to help them as they grapple with peak times, and when hopefully our peak is going to be way down the line and in time for them to send those ventilators back. But as an individual and a family here, it's been, you can imagine, in San Francisco, things are a little bit tight quarters, and we've really had to adjust, and we're finding our way. But we've got a 17-year-old, and really feeling for him and his peers, and particularly the seniors this year who are really, really struggling, and they're losing out on their graduation. So there's a lot to grapple with, but all in all, we're doing pretty well.
Well, we're glad to hear that, and definitely glad to hear that it sounds like you guys have successfully kind of flattened the curve out there. And, especially as we think about the shelter-in-place order in California, one of the topics that we've talked a lot about in the past couple of weeks has been this designation of cannabis businesses as essential services. And now, of course, with the stimulus package and the available financial assistance, we're seeing kind of a discrepancy, especially between hemp companies being eligible and marijuana businesses not. Would you speak to that a little bit, maybe as it pertains, especially in California?
Yeah, well, San Francisco was actually one of the first jurisdictions that dealt with this as an issue. Initially, the mayor's office issued a statement saying that cannabis is an essential service, and yet almost simultaneously, the city Department of Public Health sent out emails advising cannabis retail that they were going to need to shut down. And the industry locally, collectively, pushed back on that. And within 24 hours, the mayor's office in the city issued another decree saying that no, cannabis is essential, retail can remain open. And this also applies down the line to the supply chain. So folks that are licensed cultivators all the way through retail, they're essential. And that position was adopted at the state level by Governor Newsom when we went to the statewide shelter in place. The challenge is federally, if it applies to the SBA program, is that let me just take a step back. In California, marijuana is defined as, or the term is cannabis, and hemp is defined separately, much, I think, a little bit to Bob's chagrin, that we have, and it doesn't make too much sense, but we should really be talking about high THC and low THC cannabis. But nonetheless, hemp fits within the food and agricultural sector under the critical infrastructure, essential critical infrastructure workers, and that applies at the federal level as well under the FDA, because hemp is, for all purposes now, sits outside of the Controlled Substances Act. So for folks, for marijuana-related cannabis licensed entities, they're going to need to look to the state for support in getting through these tough times.
Patrick, let me piggyback on something you just said there, and maybe we can talk about this for a moment. And that really is the terminology component, not to dwell on it a whole lot, but it really does get my goat, so to speak, when they talk about, you know, cannabis and hemp. It drives me nuts. That's like saying, you know, people and men, or, you know, children and boys, you know, or it's not a classification that makes any sense. Now, I understand the social stigma, the racist construct, the history around the word marijuana, and how we want to get away from it. But simply because an agency calls itself the Bureau of Cannabis Control, does not mean that we have to call all marijuana cannabis. And particularly as lawyers, I always felt it was essential that we're very accurate. Investors look at the industry as the cannabis industry, and that it has two sides. The marijuana side, whether we like it or not, that's the legal definition of that particular plant. High THC is, like you said, another way to put it, perhaps. And then the hemp side of the industry. And those are the two legal designations of the cannabis plant. So that's really just something that's always gotten my attention, and just sort of, I understand the reason for it, but I don't necessarily agree with it because it is not accurate. And it just, to me, saying cannabis and hemp always has sounded silly. But that's just my perspective, and a lot of people, of course, disagree with that. Let me just talk for a moment, though, about COVID in California, because I read an article this morning, and if you don't know anything about this, we don't have to dive into it, but this idea that that the coronavirus was probably introduced in California in December, because of all the states in the United States, California is the state that the most Chinese tourists and most Chinese travelers arrive at. I think the number was like 8 million a year or something like this, a very, very high number. And that there's this herd immunity that's been developed without us even knowing, because it was there in California before, which perhaps explains the sort of, to your point, the flattening of the curve, or the fact that with a state with 40 million people doesn't have the drastic impact that we've seen in other places around the world. Do you have any insight, or is that something that people are talking about in your neck of the woods?
I don't hear that being talked about. I think the idea of herd immunity, we are way far out. If you listen to the toxicologists, so the folks that the immunologists, epidemiologists, the folks that are looking at COVID, we're a long way out from herd immunity, which we're going to get to through vaccines and a number of people having gotten it and having developed their own subsequent immunity to it. Here's my understanding of COVID-19 is that it first cropped up it was first identified in 2017 in a cave in China. It first cropped up at its first case in Wuhan in December, and then we got our first case. We are the first known case in the United States in Northern California, but it did not come from Chinese coming over and spreading it. It was folks that were on one of these cruises that where they, I think the folks were put into a quarantine at Travis Air Force Base up in outside of Vacaville. I think it's Solano County. And this was during a time when the administration was poo-pooing the severity of COVID, and the protocols were not in place when those folks were being quarantined. So people were coming and going. And that's how COVID started getting spread in Northern California. And as soon as they identified it, the state acted quickly and did not look to the administration for cues, but decided to go its own direction and lead the state and our citizens to some of the more progressive, advanced shelter in place and other strategies to slow down the spread so that our hospitals can handle it, unlike what's going on in places like New York and New Jersey and New Orleans and Chicago.
And then the 5G towers came around and spread it even further. No, let's not go down that rabbit hole.
There's one comment I just want to make, Bob, is just to go back to the cannabis versus marijuana conversation. I blame the federal government for adopting that term marijuana back in 1937 to begin with. But aside from that, Prop 64 codified and defined, it specifically put the term cannabis into the code. So it's a result of having that definition be in the code, not necessarily emanating from the Bureau of Cannabis Control.
Well, and you and I know that the DEA takes very seriously its responsibility, or so it would say, to comply with the UN conventions, and the UN conventions don't even use the term marijuana necessarily. They refer to cannabis. So why we ever went down that road sort of explains a lot of why that stigma gets there. I get it. I don't disagree with that history. I just think from a legal perspective, we're kind of bound to be accurate, that's the way I view it. But your points are certainly taken.
And I agree with you.
So think about this for a second. California, right? California has such a rich history with the origination of the cannabis movement, the industrial hemp movement, thinking back to Jack Herer, thinking of so many great Californians that have, moved forward with industrial hemp. When you think about people like Chris Boucher, and the list goes on and on and on, in terms of just, people that have been in this industry for some time and really helped us
David
get
Bronner.
Today. David Bronner, I mean, gosh, can you think of more recognizable people that have really been champions for our industry? But all of that said, and couple that with the fact that CBD began. Our clients started CBD, the CBD industry in San Diego, California, when you look back at cannabis, now CBD Sciences and HempMed. So this all began in California when you talk about CBD. Yet, here we are today in 2020, and California, with its complex governmental structure, does not allow for the production of CBD. It allows for hemp in limited situations, although that's gone through a twist and turn, and you're intimately involved with that on the advisory committee there in California, and the help that you've done with the trade groups. But where are we with regard to implementing CBD regulations in California?
Yeah, so a lot of the work that I do, Bob, is in the policy work, is as chief counsel for the California Hemp Council. And what that is really it's industry-funded working policy in Sacramento to advance the interests of the hemp industry, and oftentimes coming up against things rubbing these facets of the industry rubbing each other the wrong way with the cannabis folks or the high THC folks. And so last year we had a bill. It's sponsored by Assembly Member Aguiar Curry. It was AB 228, and it started out as a bill that would essentially come in and say that hemp-derived CBD is not an adulterant, and we looked at the Colorado model, and folks would get licensed so long as the hemp-derived CBD extract is manufactured by a licensed food manufacturing facility. It's not an adulterant, and it's okay to go into supplements, foods, and cosmetics. And we're just moving merrily right along. But in the midst of it, we also added on to what we were trying to do, and that created challenges. And what we were trying to do was allow for hemp-derived CBD products and hemp in general, hemp products, to get into cannabis retail. And that created a challenge at the end of the session, whereas a number of folks on the cannabis side pushed back, saying, look, if you're going to do this, we want hemp tested the same way it's being tested cannabis is being tested in the state for all the pesticides, chemicals, biocontaminants, and so forth. And we pushed back, saying that, look, we understand where you're coming from, but we have something called the Sherman Act, which is an extension of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act here. And that provides safety protections for consumers, requires testing for these contaminants, and we have a system in place, and that's what we'll be bound to. And they didn't like that, and they didn't accept that. And so they pushed back, and lo and behold, right towards the end of the session, we hadn't gotten a single vote against us as we were going through the California legislature, only to be told at the 11th hour by the chair of appropriations that we were going to be stuck, and we were not going to be getting off of what's called the suspense file because it had added costs. Even after we had met, had meetings with the administration and discussed with them the possibility of bifurcating the bill and saying, look, we understand where you're coming from. There are issues that need yet to be resolved on this, having hemp products go into cannabis retail. So we'll bifurcate the bill. We'll separate out the CBD's not an adulterant, food manufacturing facility regulatory authority by Department of Public Health from this issue around hemp products getting into cannabis retail. And the administration pushed back and basically said, look, we want a comprehensive solution. This is half-baked. Let's continue to work in the off session. Come back. We have a two-year legislative session here in California. Come back in as a two-year bill and resolve it in January. So we accepted that, and we rolled up our sleeves, and we worked with the administration and with the various facets of the cannabis industry, and we got to a place where we felt we were all in agreement on moving forward, whereby we would conduct this panel of tests, just not under the cannabis protocols and not needing to be performed by cannabis labs. Only later to find out in meetings with the administration that this still, you know, not fully agreed upon at the highest levels, and there's really a question as to how much Governor Newsom really knew about what was going on, because he supported our efforts. And then the last conversation that we've been having with the administration before COVID spiraled the way it did was that they're actually are proposing going back to a bifurcation and separating out the CBD from going into cannabis retail. So it's still a work in progress. And right now what they are looking for, what the administration is looking for, is potential economic stimulus data that will support focusing on this issue in the midst of COVID, when it looks like the rest of the session, all we're going to be dealing with are these issues. But that if we can credibly establish, and the data's there, that this will provide economic stimulus in addition to consumer protection and safety, there's still a potential pathway to get this into the budget this year, which would mean that we could potentially have passage by the end of June.
Sure.
And because the legislation has an urgency clause, it would go into immediate effect.
Well, and Patrick, I want to make sure we touch on one more thing, especially as it relates to hemp-derived products, which is the kind of the recent shift with the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment in California adding Delta-9 THC to the list of chemicals known to cause reproductive toxicity. And I want to get your opinion on, what are the implications for hemp specifically there? Because, there is a 0.3 allowance at the federal level and in the farm bill. So what do you see as being the implications of that on the hemp and CBD industry?
Yeah, so January 3rd, OEWA, the pronunciation of that strange acronym, listed both THC and cannabis smoke, marijuana smoke, on the Prop 65 list for reproductive toxicity. They had earlier in 2009 put marijuana smoke as carcinogenic on the list. But for hemp specifically, here. Okay, so here's a. It's interesting, and your listeners need to understand how this operates. It gets on. So THC is on the list, and enforcement is stayed for a year to give the industry an opportunity and time to prepare for that. What it means is that unless there is a threshold standard, a safe harbor standard that is established, a level at which we can say convincingly and through evidence that below a certain amount for daily consumption is not going to have that sort of toxicity. If that safe harbor is not established, come January 3rd, 2021, all hemp products arguably are going to have Prop 65 warning labels put on their products, which creates a real challenge for the industry when consumers are looking at labels and saying and wondering, why is it that how is it that this is going to potentially cause toxicity to me? And when there may be, like in hemp seed nut or seed oil or protein, there's negligible amounts.
Right.
Low parts per million. So the industry needs to be aware of that and needs to work together with toxicologists, probably could even be a single project to get a safe harbor amount established so that folks know, and I think CBD products might butt up against that because the THC might be a little bit higher, a little bit more concentrated, albeit below that 0.3% in the extract itself. Without that safe harbor, everybody that has, all companies that have 10 employees or more are going to have to put that warning label on their products. And I think that's going to be a challenge for the industry and with consumers and concerns raised because of it.
Yeah, that's certainly an issue that people should mobilize around, especially operators who, could be affected, their sales could be affected by that. Patrick, we can't wait to have you on here again. You are a wealth of knowledge, and we so appreciate you taking some time to be here with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric and Bob, and I really look forward to chatting again soon.
Us too. Take care. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Hoban Minutes special series on coronavirus and cannabis. You can head on over to hoban.law for more information on this podcast or the Hoban Law Group. If you have any ideas for subjects that we should be covering or any questions you want to pose to Bob or myself, shoot us an email at media@hoban.law. Stay tuned for the next episode on this special series, Coronavirus and Cannabis.